As a non-commercial educational radio station, KZSC supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KZSC staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at 831-459-4726 or by email at prc@kzsc.org. Welcome to the Pandemoscene podcast. Today we are joined by Misha Angrist, an associate professor of the practice in the Social Science Research Institute and senior fellow in the Duke Initiative for Science and Society, to talk about responses to the COVID-19 pandemic through the lens of genomics.
You're a professor trained in genetics. What do you think the genetic related things you wish the public knew about COVID-19 that you feel like is kind of being lost in the waters, in terms of like genomes, transmission, susceptibility, sociocultural factors? What role do you think you guys play in developing new information about COVID-19?
What do you mean by you guys?
People trained in genetics.
I know there's been some recent studies. There was a genome-wide association study saying, you know, people with blood group A maybe are more susceptible to respiratory failure, but I don't think geneticists have much to contribute or much more to contribute to this conversation than any other person trained in science and empiricism. And I think that's really, you know, to me, that's been the most heartbreaking. Well, it's a very crowded hit parade, but among the most heartbreaking, disturbing, apocalyptic things that have come out of the last 4 years has been this willingness to just you scientists and your data. So I don't think, you know, that genetics and genomics, you know, back years ago and when Jenny and I were both at Duke together, we worked for a guy who was very rigid disciplinary boundaries and only wanted us engaging with genomics, and genomics was different from genetics, and genetics was different from molecular biology. Well, the reality is that the rest of the world doesn't give a shit about that, those differences or those boundaries. And so I think our job, those of us, I mean, I'm not really a card-carrying scientist anymore, but I think people with that training, the most important thing we can do is to try to understand the large fraction of the world that willfully rejects, doesn't care, doesn't understand, misconstrues, and has all of these other cognitive biases that, you know, to no small extent have gotten us in this pickle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was really interesting when you were talking about the idea of like trans science, because I think that especially when we're talking about like a virus, we're talking about virology, but we're also talking about the ways that it's like impacting like real lives and like societal problems. And I think like a big reason why I feel like not a lot of things are getting done the way we need them to get done is I feel like there's a lot of barriers in science that's preventing people to take the knowledge we have with sociology and the knowledge we have with social justice and applying it to the pandemic to allow a lot of the gaps in this virus, because obviously now these gaps are costing human life, whether it's availability of testing, whether it's who gets a ventilator, those kind of questions are not now, they're not just, you know, questions in a framework, ethical framework textbook.
Right.
They're questions that are leading people to die. How do you think, what do you think is the role of science in breaking down these barriers to allow it to intersect with humanities? See, there's a big idea that science and justice cannot be reconciled. So what do you think is kind of the role of science to dismantling these barriers and allowing, you know, intersections and allowing the field to use the resources of humanities and social sciences?
Well, I think it's a really big and difficult question. I mean, I don't know where I saw it on on Twitter, which unfortunately where I see so many things. This is from a guy named Peter Sandman. And he says, public health professionals should be saying this about the public's COVID-19 risk choices. One, hundreds of years ago, doctors believed that the pure in heart were protected from getting sick. No infectious disease expert believes that today. COVID-19 doesn't care about your motives. What you do is safe or dangerous, regardless of why you do it. The job of public health professionals is to try to figure out and then communicate how safe or dangerous that is. It's a difficult job. We haven't done it very well. And he gives examples. The question of when a COVID-19 risk is worth taking and when it's foolish is not a public health question or a science question. Governments make those decisions within the range governments permit. Individuals make those decisions. We should never try to harness the credibility of public health on behalf of our judgments as citizens. 4, racial inequality is an important public health issue. Economic privation is also an important public health issue. Everyone is entitled to believe as a citizen that one of these issues is more important. No one is entitled to claim as a public health professional that demonstrating on behalf of one of these issues is more important or somehow more than demonstrating on behalf of the other. To the extent that we've done that, we were wrong. 5, for the foreseeable future, our society will be living with the virus. Some priorities are obvious. We need to protect the most vulnerable among us. We need to pay attention to congregate settings. We need to identify infected people and trace their contacts. We need to keep hospitals from being overwhelmed. Other questions are debatable. Is K-12 education important enough to take this risk? Is religious worship important enough to take the risk? Is being at a dying loved one's bedside important enough to take the risk? So I think that last group of questions are the kinds of things that the humanities can help with or help us think about. I would say bioethics could help, but I don't think it can. I think its head is too far up its own ass.
So you wrote an article, The Dangers of Diagnostic Monopolies. And it talks about, you know, like how barriers to testing as a result of a lot of monopolies can pose some kind of threat to pricing and availability of tests. With like the current healthcare policies in the United States already has created disparities in testing. What, in your opinion, what do you think steps we can take to reduce not only monopolies, but reduce the price disparities and availability disparities in regards to testing?
Well, I mean, we've done so many things wrong. And, you know, if we could go back in time 6 months, I think what we would want to do is have, you know, the Defense Production Act or some other top-down directive that says, okay, we've seen this thing in China, we are going to prepare for the worst. And we are going to use the resources and bully pulpit of the government to redirect our manufacturing capacity, making diagnostics and making PPE. and getting them to people that need them. But, you know, we've had so many stories over the last few months of how do I get a test and why can't I get a test? And I mean, I can just give you an example from my own life. You know, right now my wife is in Ohio helping her elderly parents move. And she wanted to get a test before going up there because they're 90 years old. But simply citing that as a reason was insufficient. And so she's incentivized to lie, to say, I have a fever, I have a cough. And then she can get a test for free. So there's all of those misaligned incentives. We have an overwhelmed FDA. We have a CDC that's been marginalized. We have a narcissistic 2-year-old for a president, you know, threatening to withhold PPE or tests and simply lying about how many tests have been done and, you know, a complete show. So, you know, that article you cited, that was really about patents and, you know, will people find monopolies? Will they profiteer during this pandemic? Of course, they're human beings. But I'm sort of less worried about that than the sort of downstream, you know, how are people going to get access? And, you know, how are we going to triage people who need tests, and then ultimately people who need vaccines and people who need antiviral therapy. So all of that is going to cost a lot of money.
The Santa Cruz Resource Center for Nonviolence is hosting 5 book circles discussing key works on anti-racism, as well as histories of Black and Indigenous people of color in the Americas. The book circles will begin at the end of September. Meeting dates and registration information are available at rcnv.org. Slow start to your Mondays? Wake up, everybody, with Lux every Monday from 10 a.m. to noon. Whether you're Zooming into meetings, cruising to a socially distant relaxation location, or hitting the snooze button, start your week with music by artists who are queer, trans, Black, Indigenous, and people of color. You might be tired, but wake up, everybody, we'll start your week with some fire. That's Mondays from 10 a.m. to noon, only on the Great 88.1 FM, KZSC, Santa Cruz.
How have you been finding hope during the pandemic, and like what gives you hope for the future?
Well, the short answer is not much. Because I really, you know, I'm a depressive, anxious person. And so, you know, I really feel like we are in the middle of a Margaret Atwood novel. And so that's hard. I mean, there's this kind of morbid satisfaction of, I knew the shit would hit the fan, and here we are. I think what gives me hope are, you know, I think higher education is in trouble, but that said, I think there have been some really cool and innovative things that people are thinking about. I think there has been, you know, resilience on the part of students. There has been empathy on the part of faculty. And I think the fact that, you know, this post George Floyd reckoning, I think it's, we can say, well, it's a coincidence that it happened during a pandemic. I think that's an unknowable thing. But I do think the extent to which the narrative has changed is a reason for hope. And my hope is that the same way we've seen that narrative really profoundly shift. I mean, you know, I don't know who said the poor will always be with us. I feel like racists will always be with us. My hope is that the last few months will force us to have a similar kind of reckoning about healthcare, the way doctors and patients and scientists and payers communicate with each other and deal with each other. And, you know, another hopeful thing is we've seen the environment just perk right up as soon as we stopped flying and driving and littering and whatever else. When we have a vaccine, will all of that go away? Maybe. But I don't think it has to.
Yeah, this is actually, I mean, what you're saying is just kind of leading into one of the last things we wanted to ask you, which is just kind of acknowledging that today is Shutdown STEM and a day of action to pause and reflect on the recent uprisings. You're kind of talking about it already, but I just wanted to ask you if you've had any more thoughts, especially in terms of building your course or also just through a science and society lens, but on the relation between COVID-19 and what they're calling the Fed uprisings around George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, all in the context of systemic racism and injustice.
Yeah.
Like, we suddenly cannot just talk about COVID anymore. It's, I've just been wondering, I realize it's a big question and it's all been so recent, especially the uprisings, but how we're thinking about world building and connecting the issue, you know, science and society lens, but now it's not just no longer about the pandemic, but about police brutality in the US and systemic racism and things.
Well, I was thinking about this and, you know, at the risk of indulging in the kind of conspiratorial thinking that I reject in others and criticize others for, you know, I think to the extent that the election of Donald Trump, and I would put election in quotes, because I'm not convinced it was a free and fair election. But to the extent that it was a rebuke of Barack Obama, and of course, you know, birtherism and just this constant refrain of criticism, you know, I mean, look, I was critical of Barack Obama too, usually from the left. Those seem like halcyon days now. But that sort of visceral racist view that put Donald Trump in office has brought us here. And we can say, well, the pandemic still would have happened, you know, that somebody in Guangdong still would have eaten a bat or a civet or something. I mean, we saw this 20 years ago with the SARS-1.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's also a function of capitalism. And, you know, this sort of idea of unfettered growth and the market is going to solve all of these problems, I think, you know, Trumpism is just the apotheosis of that kind of narcissism and selfishness and greed and short-term thinking and myopia. And so you know, I'm a sports fan. I'm a bereft sports fan, but I still, you know, listen to sports podcasts and go on ESPN and all of that stuff. And, you know, they're sort of trying to reckon the Colin Kaepernick arc from 2016 to now. And it just seems so petty and trivial and pathetic that these billionaires had such thin skins, and that these so-called Second Amendment patriots couldn't stomach the idea of someone taking a knee and just willfully misunderstanding what I believe this country was founded on, ignoring all of, you know, the many hundreds of years of racial injustice, but the ideals that everyone trumpets. So that's a very rambling answer to your question.
Because you have a degree in fine arts and MFA. Have you been doing any type of creative writing, or has that been the urge to creative write come to you at all during the pandemic, or thinking about what you're going to be teaching students in the summer and the fall? Have you been using this kind of like world imaginative part of you during this?
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't written fiction in a long time, but, you know, I've been trying to sell this book proposal about genomic medicine in the Anabaptists. And, you know, when I was sort of at my lowest, I was just like, I'm not going to be able to work on this until the pandemic ends, until there's a vaccine. And then I sort of dusted myself off and I started talking to the people I'd been talking to in, you know, Pennsylvania and Ohio. And I realized that I shouldn't wait, you know, and that this was the elephant in the room. And why would I try to wait it out or write my way around it? And that the thing to do was just to lean in and talk to people in those communities about how they viewed the pandemic, how they responded, and ways they've been exemplary and ways they've fallen short. And so that really, I think it's been good for me professionally, but to be honest, I think it's been even better for my mental health to sort of get me out of my own head.
This interview has explored concerns over ethics and justice that science has not been able to solve on its own. The role of justice in bridging the gaps this pandemic has revealed is now more apparent than ever. After speaking with Dr. Angrist, we are left asking, what is the role of justice when it comes to not only public health, but the sciences in general? How can we create a world in which equity as a principle is first and foremost? Is this more just world able to come from the one we are living in right now? More importantly, what ideals do we need to unlearn in order to get to that place? What is clear is that it is the resilience and imagination of students and professors like Dr. Angrist that will guide us towards a more reconcilable future. What we do know is that this future is ours to create. And with that, we would like to thank you for tuning in. Tune back in next week for another angle on the COVID-19 pandemic from the Pandemicene podcast. Thank you.